This MPI briefing, Migration and Occupational Health, Shining a Light on the Problem, was organized by MPI, the Migration and Health Research Center at the University of California, Davis, the Health Initiative of the Americas at the University of California, Berkeley's School of Public Health, and the UC Global Health Institute. The briefing, which focuses on migrants' higher rates of on-the-job injuries, was moderated by MPI Senior Vice President Michael Fix. Here's Michael.
The issues that we're going to be grappling with are very important. About 13% of the U.S. population is foreign-born, but immigrants make up about 15% of the U.S. labor force. They're overrepresented in the labor force. But really, if you look at the low-wage labor force, they're one in five low-wage workers in the U.S. economy. And we're poised to release a study quite soon in which we show that 56% of immigrant workers in the U.S. economy work in low-skill jobs. Those are jobs that are dirty, dangerous, and I heard James Rosenbaum from Northwestern last week call them often deceptive jobs. But it seemed to me as I was thinking about this session that the issue of migration and occupational health is also important. And it's important not just because it presents such a good example of what we talk about all the time here, which is policy lagging demography. It also presents a very archetypal case of science lagging demography. And this journal, I think, starts to write that balance. Imbalance, I guess, is what I should say. And, of course, here at MPI, this issue falls squarely at the intersection of work that we've been doing for years on the U.S. and international flows of labor and the mobility of labor. It's quite at the intersection of our work on immigrant integration, including, I might add, binational strategies to address immigrant integration that involve both Mexico and the United States. And it's really at the intersection. It very much represents the kind of work that we're doing on the place of labor standards, not just in the legislative reformulation of comprehensive immigration reform, but thinking more administratively as ways to fix the current employment law system so that it better serves the nation's workforce as a whole, but also the vulnerable immigrant workers who toil within it. I'm extremely pleased to have such a really distinguished panel this morning, and even though you've got their bios on your chairs, I really wanted to just hit the biographical tops of the trees, if only to preserve their names for the history of the audio recording that we're making of this session. So I'm going to go in the order of the panelists, the batting order of the panelists, their speaking order in the session this morning. And first, let me say a word about Mark Schenker, who is sitting to my left. Mark's a professor of public health sciences and medicine at the University of California, Davis, where among his many activities, he directs the Migration and Health Research Center. He's the architect of the volume that we'll be hearing about this morning, and he earned an MD from the University of California at San Francisco, and he earned his MPH from Harvard School of Public Health. And then I'm particularly delighted to say that we'll hear next from John Howard, who is the director of the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health at the Department of Health and Human Services. John holds formidably. He holds advanced degrees in medicine, in public health, in law, and in administrative law. And then following John, we're going to close the loop on hearing from the powerful people in the federal government in this field by hearing from Deborah Berkowitz. Deborah's chief of staff for the Occupational Safety and Health Administration within the Department of Labor. And among her many achievements, she's been a winner of the American Public Health Association's prestigious Alice Hamilton Award. We're then going to turn to our old friend, Bruce Goldstein, who's executive director of Farm Worker Justice. He's a labor lawyer, and he's a graduate of Cornell School of Industrial and Labor Relations, and as we know, has been an influential spokesman in this field for many years. And then our last speaker, I'm pleased to say, is Xochitl Castañeda. Sochil's a medical anthropologist, and she's the director of health initiative of the Americas at the University of California's School of Public Health at Berkeley. She studied in Mexico and Guatemala at the University of California at San Francisco, at Harvard and Amsterdam University. And among her many achievements, she was the architect of the phenomenally successful Binational Health Week, which we have actually recently studied here at the Migration Policy Institute. So I'm so pleased you could be here. Following Xochitl, I make comments for about 8 minutes. Mark will re-enter and make the final few minutes worth of comments. We've asked our speakers to speak for no more than 10 minutes, and I will try my best to politely enforce the rules, and then we'll open the session up for questions. And because the session is being taped by audio, we would like for the questioners to identify themselves and their affiliations. And then finally, in terms of housekeeping, because John and Deborah are going to need to leave after their comments, when they're finished with their comments, I'm going to open the floor for a few questions when they're done that address their comments. And then I will push on from there and will invite their colleagues, Max Lum from NIOSH and Rosemary Sokas from OSHA, to come forward and take their places on the dais. And I pledge to you all, we will end no later than 11:30. And so with that, I turn the floor over to you, Mark.
Thank you very much, Michael. It's really a pleasure to be here and talk about a topic that is of such importance, and as this session is titled, Shining a Light on This Issue, because it hasn't gotten attention enough in many different areas. As you can see, and you have the table of contents on your chairs, this issue of the journal begins to bring together a variety of studies, both on the causes of increased injury and illness among immigrants, interventions that work, policy issues, and other approaches to this, and we hope begins a lot of attention to this subject. Irving Selikoff, who was a giant in occupational health, said that statistics are human beings with the tears wiped away. So I wanted to start by a story before I present any data. And this is Maria Isabel Vasquez Jimenez. Maria was a 17-year-old pregnant farm worker in California who died 2 years ago from heat stress. Heat stress is a completely preventable cause of death. It should never happen, and yet it did. And I think the reasons for that relate to why we're here today, which is the vulnerability, the lack of ability to speak up, the lack of appropriate prevention in this case that led to this death. And I won't go into the details except to say that I think this illustrates many of those issues. This table shows you what's happened in terms of fatal occupational injuries in the United States over the last 15 years. And as you can see, there's been a decrease. And there are many reasons for this I won't go into. But if you just looked at this table, you would miss the important one for our purposes, which is occupational fatalities among Hispanic or Latino workers. And when we look at that, there's actually been a significant increase. And furthermore, on the bottom bars, you see all of that increase is in the foreign-born workers. What's happening is that there is a shift in occupational fatalities to our foreign-born workers, and the rate is actually going up in that population, and the disparity between not native-born American workers and foreign-born is getting greater in the last 10 years. So this is really the tip of the iceberg, if you will, of this, what we're talking about here, which is the increased hazardousness and consequences of hazardous work among immigrant workers. Not only is it fatalities, but it's non-fatal injuries and illnesses, and this just shows you that looking at days of disability for Hispanic workers, they're significantly greater than non-Hispanic workers. And individual studies reinforce the fact that injuries in this working population are more serious, they have longer disability, and they have other consequences as well. Well, we can go into specific occupations, and you're going to hear more about agriculture. In California, 90% of our farm workers are immigrant. Agriculture is the most hazardous industry in the country by many parameters, and the burden of that illness and injury falls largely on the immigrant workers. It also falls on the farmers and their families as well. But, for example, in California, we have up to 1 million farm workers in the state, and they have this large burden of injury and illness in agriculture. And I won't go into the specifics except to say that this is historically a first occupation for immigrant workers in the country over time, even as our immigrant population changes. Day laborers are an occupation that have been almost invisible to public health workers, and yet this is one that is populated entirely by immigrants, and the studies that have been done show injury rates 50 to 100% greater than in other industries. They show lack of workers' compensation in the majority of cases of injured workers. They show all of these consequences. And I highlight this again because this is not a standard industrial category, and yet it's one that has employed a substantial number of people in this country and in which the health consequences are very significant. Construction work is another one. Which has a large number of immigrant workers. And in studies done in construction workers, even within the same category, that is, if you look at roofers or construction helpers or the same category, the fatality rates are higher for the immigrant workers than they are for the non-immigrant workers. So it's something beyond just working in hazardous industries that affects the health outcomes in the immigrant workers. And once again, the basis for what I think the discussion here should be and how to address this imbalance. So what are some of the factors associated with this increased injury rate among immigrants? Well, here's where I think our lack of study or lack of knowledge really needs to be addressed. There are many issues that are speculated, certainly more hazardous jobs and tasks in certain industries, linguistic and cultural barriers. Recent arrived immigrants tend to have higher rates than those who have been here longer. Lack of safety training and equipment. But the one fact I would emphasize is this, what's sometimes called precarious work. That is, you have the immigrant worker who doesn't have the ability to complain about unsafe conditions, who doesn't have the ability to address those when they exist, who's unwilling to both complain and willing to take risks that shouldn't be taken on the job. And all of these contribute to this increased injury and illness rate. And I think this is actually more subtle but substantial in terms of understanding this disparity that we see between the injury and illness rate among the immigrant workers and the non-immigrant workers. And then finally, I just want to mention one more issue, which is at one extreme of the unfortunate abuse and adverse health outcomes among immigrant workers. And this was also a recent case of 2 years ago in which an immigrant herself was convicted of fraud for selling at least 800 fake asbestos removal training certificates to foreign workers. So these were foreign workers who came and someone said to them, I can give you a certificate and you can get a job with this certificate, gave them no training. They paid for the certificate, and then they go in to work in asbestos removal, which we know is one of the most hazardous jobs with respiratory disease and cancer and resulting from it. I put this in because at one extreme you have really criminal abuse, but then you have the lesser degrees of criminal abuse and then the non-criminal, all of which contribute to this disparity that I've been describing. So that is basically the overview. I encourage you to look at the articles that were on the seats or the journal issue, which you can obtain if you want to read more. And I look forward to the discussion this morning. Thank you.
Thank you. John?
Sure, and thanks, Michael. And as you heard, Debbie and I have to go to do some other activities, so I'll be very brief. Dr. Lum will be taking my place, as Michael said. You know, first of all, I want to thank Mark for asking me to write the foreword for this edition of the journal. And as I said in the foreword, you know, migration's been going on a long time. It's been going on since probably the evolutionary biologist first noted that there was a human species. And I would say that all of our ancestors, if they were able to fight off saber-toothed tigers and giant mastodons and all that to migrate around the globe, fences and border things and all that are not going to ever stop the migration of human beings to seek better lives. So that's, you know, a permanent feature of our society, and I think I want to say I'm very proud to be here at the Migration Policy Institute, where you guys struggle with all of those social, legal, and political issues. Our issues in occupational safety and health, I don't want to repeat anything that Mark said, certainly all of that. We second. At NIOSH, we're primarily a research agency, and we're doing a lot of work in occupational health disparities. And those disparities tend to be quite wide when it comes to recent immigrants, foreign-born workers in our society. And our program is small, but it's vibrant, it's passionate, and it is productive. So Max will tell you more about that. We also fund state-based surveillance programs in which states participate in collecting data, some of the data which Mark already showed you that goes into other large databases, and we've recently expanded that state-based surveillance program to add 13 new states to that system, and I think it will give us a better picture and will obviously stimulate a lot of research in that area. We're also extremely proud to work with OSHA, and I'm going to let Debbie talk about their activities. So thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm really honored to have been invited here today, and I just also want to honor the work that, you know, MPI does, because it's you know, it's because of people like you that kept this issue alive for 8 years that now we get to sort of work on it. I have to say that I feel like I'm one of the luckiest people in that, in my career, and that I now get to work for Hilda Solis, the new Secretary of Labor. She is the daughter of immigrant workers. She is the daughter of a father who had a very serious occupational illness from batteries. She gets this. She knows this. This issue is incredibly important to her, and she's given us all direction in the Department of Labor. Her goal that drives all of us here at the Department of Labor is good jobs for everyone, and by good jobs, she means safe jobs, and by everyone, she means everyone, those that are documented, those that are undocumented. I was at the Department of Labor less than 2 weeks when she asked us to hold a summit on Latino worker health and safety, and my first call was to Dr. Rosie Sokas, who's sitting there, and to John Howard and Max Lum from NIOSH, and we put together the National Action Summit on Latino worker health and safety in about seven months, where we had 1,000 people. But before I talk about that, I just want to let you know that we are very aware at OSHA about all the studies that confirm that immigrant and especially Latino workers are injured at higher rates. They die at higher rates, even in the same occupations. You know, there's a lot of data on the construction industry and in agriculture, but we're also well aware that Latino workers are getting injured in more, and immigrant workers in sort of hidden occupations, like housekeepers in a hotel, where a hotel, the overall injury and illness rate may be low, but housekeepers within hotels have one of the highest injury rates of any occupation in the service sector, and Latino housekeepers have even higher injury and illness rates. And I come out of a meatpacking and poultry workers union, which was, it's a heavily immigrant union, it's a heavily immigrant industry, and you know, the people that are dying in this industry all work on the cleanup shifts, which are at night, you know, the third shift, and those are largely populated by immigrant workers. So we are sort of, you know, well aware of this at OSHA. And our goal in OSHA, and one of the goals we have, is to reduce injuries and illnesses among all workers, and this includes immigrant workers. And our goal is to reduce injuries and illnesses among immigrant workers by educating them about their rights under the law and enhancing their ability to use those rights, which I think is really key to this whole process. We launched our focus on immigrant workers on April 14th and 15th with our National Action Summit on Latino Worker Health and Safety. When we first started the conference, we thought there'd be 250 people. Then we thought there'd be 500. We had 1,000 people from all over the country attend the summit. And for the first time, under the house of the federal government, we brought together Latino and other immigrant workers, community groups, faith-based organizations, employers, unions, consulates, safety advocates, lots of representatives from the federal and state government, the medical community, and other sort of non-traditional partners, some who are, a lot of you who are here today, National Council of Raza, who, you know, had never done work with us before. And the goal was to develop new strategies and partnerships to reduce injuries and illnesses among Latino workers. So one of the goals that we had at the conference was to increase our outreach to day labor community-based groups and faith-based groups that deal with immigrant workers, and other organizations like National Council of Raza that can reach out to sort of vulnerable workers so that we can partner with them so that they can bring education and training to immigrant workers about what their rights are under the law, but also that we are allowing them to serve as employee representatives so they can file complaints on behalf of these workers to OSHA, which is how you get an OSHA inspection in your workplace and helps us better target sort of the most dangerous industries. We're also looking to the consulates and faith-based groups to help us partner to reach immigrant workers who are very scared, especially Mexican workers, to call anybody in the federal government. And one example of that is something that we did jointly with the Wage and Hour Division in the Department of Labor. We did it during the winter this year. We created a partnership where Catholic Migration set up a 1-800 number that for immigrant workers to call, where we used AARP members. We trained them, you know, who spoke Spanish in OSHA rights and wage and hour, and we publicized this through the churches, and we did this jointly with the Mexican consulate, the federal government, wage and hour, Department of Labor, and the State Department of Building and Trades or something like that. And so we have been publicizing in all the churches for immigrant workers to call this 1-800 number if they have questions. And they call the Catholic Charities. They're not calling us, and then Catholic Charities then refers it to us. So it's sort of a safe place for workers to call, and it's a pilot that we'd like to sort of spread around the country. In addition to these kinds of new partnerships and programs to bring needed education to immigrant workers and also to help them be able to utilize their rights free from retaliation, is we also were looking at new strategies that we can do in terms of enforcement with immigrant workers. And so the Secretary of Labor announced two initiatives recently. One was that now when our compliance officers go out to a workplace, they check to make sure that required training is provided to workers. So if you're supposed to be trained on the job you're doing because it's dangerous, we check to make sure it was provided. Now we're going to check to make sure it was provided in the language that workers can understand and the vocabulary workers can understand. And I'll just give you an example of what happens to immigrant workers, and that is the end of March, we cited a company in Nebraska for about $200,000 after a Latina woman was crushed to death. She was on a road crew after being caught in a paving machine she was cleaning. It turns out she had not been trained on how to clean the machine safely and had not been given the manual to read. And when our compliance officer asked the supervisor why this worker wasn't trained, he replied that the manual is not shared because the majority of the employees speak Spanish, and they were all illiterate. They just know their name. So our compliance officer then took about 15 minutes. We have at OSHA, because we have a lot of compliance officers that speak Spanish, but a lot that don't. We have a number you call, and you get a translator immediately on the phone, and that's how our compliance officers work. And we translated the first page of the manual, and he sort of wrote it down. And then he went to all the other workers on the crew to see if they could read it, and they all read it, and they all understood it. But that's sort of, you know, the employer had failed to share the safety information with employees because he figured since they were Latino, they couldn't speak English and they couldn't read, and that's just outrageous and it's reprehensible, and we're determined to change that culture. In addition, OSHA is a very small agency. This is my steady drum beat here. EPA has 17,000 employees. We have 2,000 for the same jurisdiction. And so we need to expand our sort of eyes and ears. And so we're launching a pilot initiative with 14 different cities where we're training the building inspectors in all of those cities because construction is one of the most dangerous industries. And in construction, a third of the employees are Latino workers, and they had those Latino workers die at higher rates and get injured at higher rates. So we're training them on the leading causes of death among construction workers. So if they see somebody without fall protection or they see an unguarded trench, they will call us, and then we will go out and do an inspection. So it's a way for us to sort of get out to workplaces where we usually wouldn't get called by a worker. And so we've started to sort of put that in the works. In addition, we've launched an inspection initiative to drill down on employers that intimidate and discriminate against workers who report injuries and illnesses. And as Mark said, workers overall are intimidated to report injuries and illnesses to employers because they, you know, unfortunately, employers often fire them when they report an injury and illness. And that's not legal under our law, but workers don't know that, and so they don't file complaints. But with immigrant workers, it's even worse. All the studies have shown that immigrant workers even report less and even file less in workers' comp. So, you know, we've launched that initiative. And in addition, we have a limited amount of money in grants that we give out to nonprofits to educate workers about their rights. And we have changed that grant. It's called the Susan Harwood Grants to include a planning grant that would be available for sort of day labor centers and interfaith worker centers and community groups who have never applied for this money before to actually apply for it. And we are encouraging them to apply, and we actually had them all in the Department of Labor and talked to them to apply. So that was very exciting. And in addition, and Dr. Sokas will talk more about this, and we're working with NIOSH on this, you know, we are working on including clinics and especially the migrant medical community and helping us with worker surveillance, you know, how immigrant workers are getting injured, what are the industries they're getting injured, what are the plants they're getting injured in, so that we can better sort of target our resources. So this is really a big focus of us at the Department of Labor, and we, you know, expect to continue it. So thank you.
Very, very good. Let me just say, since we've lost John, and I don't know how soon we're going to lose.
I can stay to 11.
Debbie, why don't we just ask, are there any questions of Deborah right now? And if so, we'll move on. Former Department of Labor employee David North, yes.
Thank you. I not only am a former Department of Labor employee, I think I am also a former political appointee to a former Democratic secretary, John Kennedy's second secretary, the late Willard Wirtz. My question to you, ma'am, is that, and to the rest of the panel, is that I've been listening for half an hour and haven't heard the word that I would expect to hear. I presume within the grouping of migrant workers who get hurt or who suffer industrial diseases and so forth, that the people most likely would be the illegal immigrants. And nobody has mentioned that, and I wonder why. And I would suggest that were there fewer of them, your problems might not be so great.
Do you want to quickly respond? Because we're going to save that for the rest of the panel. I mean, this is just...
I appreciate your question. I would say I'm not so sure that... I mean, that's not our findings at all, actually. And... And we protect workers whether they're documented or not documented. But I have to say that at the Latino Summit, we had 5 Latino workers who spoke in Spanish and told their story to the 1,000 participants. All were legal and all had incredibly tragic stories of abuse, including Juanita, who was on a... construction crew that were being loaded down on a scaffold where they overloaded it, even though the workers knew it was overloaded, but the employer overloaded it, and the scaffold broke. He survived. 3 other workers got killed, and he was legal and all his work, you know, legal. So we don't see that issue.
Don, did you have a question?
Yeah, I do. Don Kerwin from Migration Policy Institute. I wonder if you could actually talk more about that. And, Bruce, maybe you could answer that question about how important it is to be status blind in enforcement, to be effective on enforcement. But also, for Ms. Berkowitz, I want to know a little bit more about how you're targeting the surveillance program, how you're actually targeting your resources.
Well, we don't actually do surveillance. That's not – we're an enforcement agency.
Allows workers to complain based on, and they're doing surveillance, and you're basically targeting resources as a result of that? Investigative resources.
Okay, what I'm saying is that OSHA has limited resources, so we have to target how we go in and inspect and where we inspect. And it's also, we have a pretty weak law, the OSHA law. And... there have been a lot of court cases. We can't just walk into a workplace. There has to be a reason. A worker has to call us in. There has to be a referral. We have to know it's a dangerous industry. So one of the ways we can target is through our building initiative. It's our initiative with building inspectors, where if they find serious hazards that aren't being corrected, you know, they can call us, and we'll come in, and that'll be a referral. And Dr. Sokas can talk with you more about involving the medical community in trying to figure out where people are getting hurt and what kind of industries when she gets up there.
Please.
Thank you. My name is Javier Diaz. I'm from the Embassy of Mexico. And I just want more than a question, it's a comment, to thank OSHA and NIOSH for, because we've had a very exciting partnership. It's been going for a while, especially with OSHA, especially on June 1st, actually, Dr. Marcos and the Ambassador of Mexico renewed their agreement to collaborate, and we are very proud and very happy to try to be helpful with you in terms of creating an outreach to our community to get all this information out there and to be partners with you on this issue. We have already actually started, discussing interesting initiatives. Actually, last week, OSHA was kind enough to help us get in contact with some of your regional officers in the South to look at what's going on with immigrant workers working on the cleanup process in the Gulf, which is, of course, a concern for everybody. And that's an example of one of the things that, the exciting possibilities that are out there. And we expect this year, like we did last year, to hold a labor week, like we did last year, with a strong help and commitment of Secretary Solis, like we did last year, and to expand what we did in 2009. So more than that, it's a recognition, and a thank you for everything.
Thank you very much.
We have worked very closely with the embassy and the consulates, and the Mexican embassy and consulates, and that's been great. And, I want to tell you that Secretary Solis went to the Gulf last week and went on the beach down in Port Fouchon and spoke to all the Latino workers that were working there. And I just want you to know that when we started this process with the league, BP only wanted to hire English-speaking workers. And, we pushed back very hard because the communities down on the beaches and the ports are Vietnamese fishermen and Latino workers. And so, they translated their material. They got translators. We published stuff in Vietnamese and in Spanish for the workers. And so we're just keeping, the company's feet to the fire here.
Great. Great, thank you. Let's move on with the panel then. Bruce, you're on the schedule next.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. Farm Worker Justice is a national organization that works to improve the occupational safety and health of migrant and seasonal farm workers. We engage in advocacy, litigation, and education and training. And we work with many groups around the country to accomplish those goals. As you've heard from Dr. Shanker, the injury rates and death rates from occupational injuries and illnesses in agriculture are very high, and there's some statistics that you have in your packets. Some of the most serious safety and health hazards they include the lack of drinking water and toilet facilities in the fields. Over the last 5 years, there have been about 15 deaths in the fields from heat-related injuries and illnesses. Maria Velasquez Jimenez in California is just one of them. There are pesticide poisonings. A few years ago, the EPA estimated that about 10,000 farm workers are poisoned each year in the fields. Just a few years ago, some workers working for the same company with tomatoes, I believe it was, in North Carolina and Florida, three women gave birth to babies with very severe birth defects, and those injuries have been associated, those birth defects and those children have been associated with their exposure to pesticides in the fields during that season. There are musculoskeletal injuries from lengthy stooping, lifting, cutting in the harvest crops, as well as falls from ladders when the workers go up in the trees to pick fruit. There are injuries from farm machinery and transportation vehicles. There also needs to be a recognition that we're not just talking about acute injuries in the short run, but we are talking about the fact that pesticides can cause cancer and other chronic illnesses over many years. Most of these injuries and deaths are preventable. There are a number of factors why these are occurring. Immigration status is certainly a key factor. For most of our history in this country, farm workers have been a transnational labor force. Currently, about 85% of farm workers are foreign-born. Somewhere between 52% and 70% of farm workers lack authorized immigration status. Increasingly, these immigrants come from southern Mexico and Guatemala, where they are from indigenous communities. Many of them do not speak Spanish or English. They speak other languages, and very often they have very limited education. They work hard. They're very productive in American agriculture, but they don't have the education or access that they need to improve their occupational safety and health. And since so many of them are recent immigrants and many of them are undocumented, they feel very threatened by the idea of coming forward. Few are willing to join a labor union to advance their interests. There's also just the poverty and backwardness of much of agricultural employment. The wage rates are very low, and many jobs in agriculture are seasonal. So not only are the wage rates low, but their annual earnings are even lower. A lack of modern practices in much of agriculture. Many fruit and vegetable pickers earn money based on a piece rate. The workers don't have much of an incentive to walk down the field to drink water or use the bathroom because the employer will not pay them for that time. They will only pay them for how much they pick. They're making the choice between their health and their poverty. Access to health care is very limited. Less than 15% of farm workers, and it's probably a lot less than this, obtain health insurance through their employer. Many are, because they're undocumented, those workers are not eligible for Medicaid. The federally funded system of community health centers reaches only about 20% of farm workers in this country. Other barriers include lack of transportation, difficulty getting to the doctors due to long work hours. In addition, some pesticide poisoning and some other things can be difficult to diagnose because it can produce flu-like symptoms, resulting in inadequate treatment. Another key factor is that the occupational safety standards in this country discriminate against farm workers. Few of OSHA's standards actually apply to farm workers. There are protections that apply to other occupations that should apply to farm workers, like standards about ladder safety, but farm workers are excluded. There are some specific standards that should apply to agriculture, but OSHA hasn't adopted them. There are problems with vehicle safety. There are some rules about the transportation of farm workers for work, but those vehicles don't have to have seat belts. When farm workers are being transported in vehicles and they get into an accident, they suffer injuries and deaths that are just unnecessary due to the lack of seat belts. Another policy issue is that each year Congress has a quote-unquote rider on the appropriations bill for the Labor, Health, and Human Services and Education Act. The OSHA is prohibited from enforcing their standards in agriculture unless the employer has 11 or more employees. And so some states actually cover all workers, but at the federal level, OSHA doesn't. And one of the problems is that in agriculture, a lot of growers now are using labor contractors. The grower says, I don't employ any farm workers. The labor contractors employ the farm workers. And so the labor contractor says, well, I'm small. You know, I don't have to comply. As to pesticides, OSHA does not regulate chemicals in the workplace for farm workers related to pesticides. The EPA regulates them. But the EPA is not a worker protection agency. It hasn't adopted the same standards that apply to other workers exposed to chemicals, like a very specific right-to-know standard about the chemical and the way to prevent harm and what to do when the harm actually occurs. Workers' compensation, a number of states discriminate against farm workers by excluding them altogether from workers' compensation or discriminating against them in the benefits and coverage that are applicable. Consequently, in these states, many of which are in the South, but not only in the South, these employers have no real incentive to spend money on safety precautions because the workers don't have workers' compensation available, they're not going to file a lawsuit, and so the employer doesn't have to worry about an insurance company saying, hey, you've got high claims, you know, you've got to spend more money to make things safer. There's also just a lack of enforcement. It's very weak. All of this is compounded by the fact that farm workers are excluded from the National Labor Relations Act. They can be fired for organizing a labor union or getting together as a group and demanding safer working conditions. Outside agriculture, people are protected. In California, there is a collective bargaining law that protects workers in agriculture, but many workers feel that the enforcement is not adequate, and many undocumented workers are afraid to join a union despite the theoretical protection of the law. So we have a few recommendations around policy issues. Obviously, a great deal of research needs to be done because we don't know enough about farm workers. But immigration reform is needed. We need a path to legal immigration status for farm workers. We need an earned legalization program. The Ag Jobs Bill would do that. Legal immigration status will enable many farm workers to request safer work practices and obtain health care when they are injured. We need to end discrimination in key occupational safety and health protections. OSHA needs to address agriculture specifically. Today there's an article in the New York Times about the heat stress protections that BP is engaged in to protect the workers working in the Gulf cleaning up the spill. And they have a picture of a canopy, and workers are taking a break to drink water and get out of the sun, and they're being paid for that time. Well, that doesn't happen in agriculture. In California, they recently adopted a shade standard that doesn't apply at the federal level, but there needs to be more enforcement of that shade protection. OSHA should really you know, protect workers, not EPA, regarding pesticides. And as I said earlier, we need to have specific standards. Ladder protection standards need to be applied to agriculture. There's no reason why a person working construction or a factory can have safety standards related to ladders in those settings, but a farm worker working on the same ladder, picking the apples off a tree, doesn't have those protections. Ms. Berkowitz indicated, the government, this administration, recognizes that there needs to be greater outreach to community-based organizations, and that the government needs to be sensitive to the cultural, educational, linguistic differences of those communities. There also needs to be international-level cooperation to address occupational safety and health, because there is international migration. The workers need to be educated and worked with in their home countries, so they get this information while they're home before they come into the country. We need to strengthen international institutions, and the United States government needs to recognize that other nations around the world have adopted standards for their agricultural workers that are similar and equal to the standards in other occupations for those countries. The United States needs to adopt the international recognition that agricultural workers should be treated similarly to other workers. Again, thank you very much.
Bruce, very good. Right within your time limit, I'm very impressed.
It's because I'm New York, I speak fast.
So, Jill?
Thank you. I want to start. I was asked to do like the grappling, and it's very difficult because I think you have done it. But I want to start quoting Secretary Solis. She said that Latinos represent an integral and essential part of key industries that keep our country running every day. However, many of these workers are employed in dangerous and hazardous professions and afraid to speak up for their rights. Many work in the shadows, often in deplorable conditions, and are regularly exploited by unscrupulous employers. The gentleman was asking about illegals. I don't think they are illegals. I think, unfortunately, migration divides between documented and undocumented workers and divides families. And being a phenomenon that has been the motto of history, today it's a problem. And it's a problem that puts citizens unable to claim their rights, Mrs. Berkowitz. Sometimes we want to have rights, but this is a society based on rights, and because of that, it's a society of enemies, where the ones who have certain rights, in this case being documented, can apply or have health insurance, can claim for certain issues that others cannot. So I think we need to rehumanize migration. And if that's something that I want to leave in this table today, is that people who migrate are human beings who have fears, who have dreams. The main motivation, we said, is economic. I think the main motivation for those of us who move from one country to another is hope. We come here because we hope to have a better life. We hope to provide our kids, our families, with a better quality of life. And sometimes we put in danger and jeopardize our own life here, accepting to work in jobs where nobody can. Sometimes we said Mexicans. So in that sense, I want to say that on this, we, without martyrizing one group vis-a-vis the other, it's unfortunate that among the migrant population, 44% of all the fatal injuries are among Mexicans. The next group is Guatemalan with 4%. So definitely, and this is going to be kind of my three issues that I want to say, more works need to be done in research and training to really understand what are the risk perceptions of this population that take this risk, or being informed or not informed, have these injuries and have these health problems? Is just an issue of language? Is just an issue of culture? Or it's a hierarchy of risks, and they have to face risks like having a place to live, having something to eat, having a debt to pay, and to be careful with a ladder might not be in the hierarchy perceived as higher risk as others. So we really need to be creative in the research part and really think out of the box to avoid unnecessary deaths and accidents among this population. I think another area, it's the access to health services and to the access to health in general. Unfortunately, in this country, health is not a human right. It's a service. It's a commodity that we buy or sell according to many issues. And unfortunately, we just lose a historical opportunity to have an inclusionary health reform. I think it was not a health reform, but it was more a health insurance reform. But even there, we lost a historical opportunity, excluding a sector that is really the most at risk, who is performing the most dangerous jobs. And now this sector will need to buy their health insurance in without any subsidy. But there is some packages of money that were left for the clinics and for other kind of health promotion and health education matters, and I urge the authorities to really ask the clinics to do outreach in a very innovative manner, to tell the people that they can access the services, because fear is some of the things that do not allow the people to access the services. I just come on Saturday from my office in the Central Valley, and you know what I saw there at that moment was, you know, fear. We were vaccinated against H1N1, and people were saying, why? The government now is it really wanted to take care of us. No, I'm not going to take the vaccine. Maybe have something. It's the first time that we are having that opportunity. So a lot of education needs to be done in that matter. And in the policy arena, that will be the third issue that I think we need to do more work. Immigration reform is imminent. Sooner or later, I don't know, I hope sooner than later. And I think the people who are in this side fighting for immigrants, for their rights, for having a more egalitarian planet, we really think we need to think in advance. What are going to be the health issues that this immigration reform needs to place? And what are going to be the occupational issues for these workers? Because the majority of immigrants are workers and are currently employed. So I just want to end up my remarks by saying that the health of a country is also the health of its immigrants. And it's also the health of all its workers. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And Xochitl has agreed to speak for a little less than 10 minutes and to cede the balance of her time to Mark, who will wrap things up for us, and then we'll go to questions.
And what I'd like to do is to lead us into the policy discussion that we're really here for. I just want to start with a couple comments. First, to thank you, Debbie, and everyone on the panel for
thank
really
so much,
eloquent presentations.
We'll be in touch.
Okay. As a physician, I took an oath that said I would treat everyone regardless of race, gender, ethnicity, et cetera. And I remember years ago when we did that, we talked about which groups we would have difficulty treating. But we all knew as physicians that our responsibility was to treat everyone. And I think the public health equivalent is that we look at the health of the whole population. And so that's my response to this question of different categories, is that as a public health person, I don't
even think that's an issue. It's not a discussion. The second brief point is this is an international phenomenon. The United States is not unique at all. Immigration occurs around the world, usually developing countries to developed countries, and these issues really do need a global approach and understanding. And I think we can learn from other countries as well as hopefully teach other countries about how this might be done. So to summarize some of the points from the morning, immigrants work in the most hazardous jobs and industries, have higher rates of fatal and non-fatal injuries than non-immigrants, even within the same occupations. And even though there hasn't been a lot of research, this has clearly come out, and if you read the articles in the journal, you'll see this. Health care for immigrant workers is limited, and disability from occupational injuries and illnesses is greater. There's been little occupational health, epidemiologic, or public health research on this subject. There are a lot of reasons for this. Sometimes it's politically sensitive. It's more challenging to study a population that might not speak the dominant language, that might be mobile, that might be afraid to respond. But to me, that's really the challenge that we need to address, because this is where the higher injury rates are and, indeed, the greater return on our efforts if we can reduce this health disparity. And then, finally, immigrant workers deserve, as we've heard, the same occupational health and safety protection as non-immigrant workers. We're not going to eliminate occupational injuries and illnesses, but we shouldn't have this disparity. We shouldn't have this different outcome for workers in one class as for workers in another. So what do we need to do? Well, here's for our discussion. I think we've heard about current regulations that exempt employees from National Labor Relations Act, Fair Labor Standards Act, OSHA protections if you're in a certain category or a workplace with under 10 or under fewer employees. You're not protected, and that makes no sense, especially because it largely will discriminate against the workers we're talking about. And efforts to eliminate that discrepancy would be one direction. There's a proposal by Department of Labor for the Protecting American Workers Act, PAWA, and this is another effort to, again, reduce this illness and injury burden among immigrant and low-paid workers with a lot of pieces to it that I won't go into the detail, but would help address what we're talking about. I personally think that research is important, not just to understand what's going on and to shine a light on it, but also to look at what interventions are possible and whether they're effective and how to achieve them. So we need to be looking at analytic studies, where is this occurring, in what subgroup, in what outcomes. We need to be looking at interventions. How do you address this difficult to reach population? And we heard some comments about some of those issues, especially from Debbie, in terms of innovative approaches. And then we need to look at what policies are possible and how they can be implemented. And so really funding that. And again, this issue of shining a light, if we're not looking at this, it becomes invisible. Nobody's aware. We just look at that first table I showed you and say, uh-huh, occupational fatalities are decreasing. We must be doing it right. And yet that's not the story. And it's the same for many of these other outcomes. If you're not looking at these groups and who's affected and why, you might miss that story. For example, the heat illness fatalities, the number is smaller than heat illness in the elderly who tend to be not working, but they're completely preventable. And without looking at that and saying, what about that group of 18 to 65-year-olds and what's going on there, you don't see what's going on and you don't address it. workers' compensation is deficient in terms of immigrant workers. All the studies I've seen illustrate that point. There are a lot of reasons for it. I think that needs to be addressed and improved. Healthcare for migrant workers is a particular challenge, not just because of the poverty, but because of other realities of their work. And I think we need to look at how to improve that. And then finally, we've heard about immigration reform. And I think within that debate, the issue of protecting workers, which is why most people are coming here, needs to be addressed. So that's basically a launch for our policy discussion. My acknowledgments are here. It's all the people that we're doing this for, and I thank them every time when I do this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Can I invite Max and Rosemary Sokas to come down and join us at the front? Because I know some of us may have questions for the Departments of Labor and for NIOSH. I certainly do. So let's start with questions from the floor. We've had some excellent presentations. Please.
I'm David Strauss from the Association of Farm Worker Opportunity Programs. And I guess I wanted to just, I think it was Mark's third point that he just made, or second point. Anyway, we found in our efforts to especially advocate for farm worker youth in equalizing protections, there's this wonderful game that goes on in Washington. It's actually not wonderful, I'm being sarcastic, which is you bring a social problem to the attention of good policymakers up on the Hill that they're poised to help. And, of course, what they do is calculate quickly the equation, which is you're talking about non-voters, people have no power, no money. Why should I do anything? And so the first question back is, let's see your data. It's an excellent question because we don't have it. So I guess it's a long-winded way of saying we've got to have that on all the questions that are being addressed. We need way better data. And I guess the question is, how do we do it? How do we get that money? Because a lot of us have tried different angles, and it costs a lot of money to count farm workers, to track what happens to them on health and safety and other issues. So what recommendations would you have for how we can try to affect that problem of lack of funds for research?
Well, I think it's an excellent question, and I have two comments. One, if you look at the article in the journal on the California Agricultural Workers Health Study, that was funded by the California Endowment, NGO foundation funding is one source. But that's difficult, and they don't have a lot of money, and they tend not to fund research. Even the California Endowment is now funding less research. I think the other is an effort needs to be made to educate Congress and to speak to some of these other questions, not just the political power, or maybe that's part of the discussion. But when I speak, I bring the data that do exist, and I say, I'm a public health person. This needs to be addressed, and we need support to look at this. Now, what often happens is you have a lot of people who are looking at disease-specific research. We'll look at heart disease, or we'll look at kidney disease, or whatever, and not the populations. And so perhaps some way to get those agencies in Washington to start to look in a different way at this and say, here's a population at risk for a whole range of outcomes. And then finally, I would say NIOSH, they're a small agency, but they have certainly stepped up and provide support.
Bruce, go ahead.
Yeah, just real briefly, we could talk for hours about our broken congressional situation, but just one small point is that after the 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act was passed, legalizing about 3 million people, and 1.1 million of whom were farm workers who had been undocumented,
the government rightly said, you know what, we really need to study what we've just done to figure out what we just did and plan for the future. And so there was a lot of research money available around farm workers, at least, and it yielded a lot of studies that were very, very helpful. So there's another reason to do immigration reform.
Study what's done.
Yeah, if I could just interject two quick things here. First of all, one of the things that we argue for when we think about comprehensive immigration reform is a reintroduction of just those studies that were done after the 1986 Immigration Act. And so one of the things we need to think about is what the design of those studies should be, whether who we follow and for how long we follow them. I have a question for Bruce and for anybody in the room who happens to know the answer to it. It's always struck me that the National Agricultural Workers Survey had some set of questions which got to some extent at the question of the health and the preventive measures that and the risks that farm workers encountered out in the fields. It was quite an ambitious study that was carried out periodically by the Department of Labor. Does anybody know what its current status is?
I can tell you some about that. It still exists. There's still some level of funding that's been allocated for it. Like everything else in the federal government, the amount of funding determines the amount of work that can get done. And this has been kind of kept alive through thick and thin by very dedicated people within the Department of Labor who are working on it. But it really is on a shoestring right now. And so, Daniel Carroll is the project officer on that. He's been working very hard over the last number of years in collaboration with some people in Health and Human Services. NIOSH has been helpful at times. The Health Resource and Service Administration at times has provided some funding. EPA has provided some funding to keep it alive over the years. But it's what's impressive to me about this program is it's all subcontracted out to research organizations, and they've addressed issues like the language needs of newer immigrants where it's indigenous languages in different parts of Mexico. The more complicated the questions get, the fewer people they can put into their survey, and so the budget gets to be more dire. So we're not allowed to make pitches for budget issues, but that certainly is one where resources would be useful.
Thank you.
Just briefly, the National Agricultural Workers Survey, or NAWS, was a product of the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986, and it has continued, and there were efforts to end it, and a number of us in the room actually worked together to continue it. And they do a very good job of finding where farm workers really are. They go out to very untraditional places where many farm workers are living, in the fields, in the backs of trucks, in trailers, and they interview them effectively in their native language. And to me, it may be a model for some other populations. They do sometimes get funding to ask some specific questions they hadn't asked before, so there are some health-related questions. I don't know the exact ones that are occurring right now.
Yes.
Just there was another question, I think, that you had, or point that you had, and that is that I think we're looking at the surveillance end as important, but also the impact end. NIOSH has been working tractor turnovers for 20 years. I think we know a lot about tractor turnovers. I don't think we necessarily need any more surveillance, although I'm sure there are researchers in NIOSH probably say we need to know, fine-tune it. But what's the impact of what we're doing? And I just want to thank, at this point, the Mexican government for stepping up and opening what I think is a tremendous initiative, the Ventanillas program. The Ventanillas de Salud program is this opportunity of health windows in consulates. And having been in El Paso a couple of years ago and seeing 300 or 400 people standing in line waiting to go into the consulate, my background, I immediately think that's a marketing opportunity. There are people there standing in line. They're obviously not there for safety information necessarily about their own worker safety and health, but it's an opportunity. So how do we organize what we have, the materials we have, maybe deliver them in a little different way, and then how do we measure that? And even if it's just small community studies, I think it'll give us a good focus in terms of the impact of our research. And again, it feeds back into our needs assessment.
Yeah, you know, we always say that the consular offices are probably the most unsung integrating institutions in the U.S. society.
This is Catherine Stingley from the National Council of ORASA. And my question, well, comment and then question for whoever wants to take it, is about the outrage of the problem and why we're at a point where a tragic death doesn't incite the same reaction from the public and from Congress as a tragic death in other circumstances. I think the mine tragedy a couple months ago is a good example of workers who were working in conditions that should have never existed, who filed complaints that were heard too late, and the consequence was a fatality. And how come we find ourselves year after year with nearly 1,000 workers killed, a rate at which is actually higher than some developing countries, and it doesn't incite the same sort of policy change or hearings and congressional movement that came out of the mine accident, or why that is such a short-lived kind of reaction in the public mindset, and what we can do about that.
I think you've touched on something that's actually historic in terms of occupational health, and that is that mass tragedies have, over time, captured a lot more public attention than, for example, deaths in agriculture, which occur one here and one somewhere far off there and one isolated somewhere else. And agriculture's lag behind the heavy industries, which were much more, beneficial from those unfortunate tragedies or benefited from them. So that's one answer. But I would really pass this to Max Lum, because I think there is power in these isolated events in terms of how they're communicated, how they're used in terms of the public awareness and discussion. And I can tell you that they can capture attention, and I think we in public health need to be more sophisticated in how that's done, not to benefit from tragedy, but to really be more sophisticated in our media and our communications and how that is used. So I don't know, Max, if
you... Well, I think overall, and it's just dismaying that we tell our story so badly. And that, you know, the government has to take some responsibility here to even the good services that we provide and to tell it in a way that energizes people. I mean, to me, I it's a great question, because I don't understand the issue of tractor rollovers in this country. I don't understand why that doesn't, when you lose 40, 50 kids a year you don't have to lose, and their children, why that doesn't emote, you know. Why don't we tell that story better? We've tried different ways to do that. But I think it's just an issue of us talking a little bit more in forums like this, but to develop some more cogent stories that reach down and get those stories to the Congress and the policymakers. That's sort of a punt, but it's, I don't know the answer, I think, to that question.
Yes. Hi. My name is Maggie Ellinger-Lock. I'm an intern at Farmworker Justice. And since I've been there, I've been kind of rolling within my mind this question that the woman from the National Council of ORASA posed. And it seems to me that, well, with the history of agricultural workers being recent immigrants, kind of the invisibleness of these workers, the remoteness of the locations, and the fact that they're excluded from so many labor protections, all kind of seem to boil down to one thing, and that's racism. And I think we can see that in the language that we use, like the media calling people illegals, which I think is very clearly racist. And I think that's the kind of elephant in the room that I haven't really been hearing addressed. I'm just curious if the panel could speak to that.
I just want to give one statistic, which is that 2/3 of the foreign-born labor force in the United States has been in the United States for 10 years or more. We tend to always think of it as a recently arrived labor force, and in and even in agriculture and construction, where it is a lot of it has recently arrived, it's a kind of a mischaracterization. It's much more established and permanent than we often think.
I completely agree with you. I think one of the big problems is racism. If it will be occurring in other groups, might be over there. And I am very pleased that you represent the National Council of La Raza, kind of the institutions who have to be there really advocating for this to stop, because it's the racism who is an element that adds to the drama of the situation of an occupational health.
Well, as you can see, farm worker justice attracts summer law clerks who think deeply about the issues that we work on. I think racism is clearly a component, a factor in all of this. For farm workers, the reason why farm workers were left out in the 1930s of most of the major labor protections was that a deal was cut. The Southern Democrats agreed to support labor protections as long as the African Americans, working in agriculture at the time, were not going to be protected. And so a deal was cut. The liberals and the pro-labor people in Congress said, we're going to come back. We'll cover agriculture in, next year or two. And that was National Labor Relations Act was passed in 1935. But clearly, we've done things in agriculture to make sure that there's a marginalized labor force. So you have immigrants, you have guest workers, people who are not legally allowed to switch employers unless the employer decides to switch them. We've done things to disempower people in agriculture that contributes to all this, but it doesn't explain everything. The people who died, I didn't look at the statistics yet, but I'm assuming that almost all the people who died in the mine explosion in West Virginia were white people. And so part of that I attribute to the fact that there was no labor union. The workers were not organized, and they didn't have an effective voice to overcome what the employer was trying to do. And, of course, there's also some responsibility on the part of the government for not adequately enforcing the laws. So it's not all about race, even though race is certainly an important factor.
Hi, I'm Patricia Fox, and also of the National Council of La Raza. And I wanted to ask any one of you who can answer this, if you can speak a little bit about the role of subcontractors in all of this. Bruce mentioned labor contractors in agriculture, but of course there are subcontractors in many other industries. And we've been hearing an awful lot about workers, Latino workers who are reporting abuses, who often point to the role of subcontractors, who seem to be existing in this sort of murky space between employers and some sort of informal economy. And I was just wondering if there are attempts at enforcement of subcontractors as well as employers.
Yeah, I'll try to answer some of this. That's a huge issue because of the murkiness that it adds to a lot of the responsibility and the ability to enforce specific regulations. There's been some careful interpretations that have been made to allow OSHA, for example, to go in some circumstances to go after subcontractors. But one of the biggest issues is that it's created kind of the shadowy area. There are attempts now to make sure that, for example, when people are called subcontractors, and sometimes day laborers will get called subcontractors, that this is not a deliberate misclassification of the way people are working in an attempt to get around wage restrictions and overtime requirements and minimum wage rates. The whole issue of self-employed individuals, whether they're subcontractors or whether they're day laborers, is really critical, because if you look at mortality rates in fatal traumatic injuries in the workplace, one of the highest groups are the people who are classified as self-employed. So, and that's true in farming populations as well as in, you know, other construction work and that sort of thing. And part of it is that there may be a blurring of those lines and nobody's paying attention. Part of it is that the smaller you get in terms of the employer, the less likely they are to know about safety and health, the fewer resources they may have, the more likely they're to just ignore everything. And so we have this enormous problem. Some of it is clear fraud, and to the extent that laws exist that could get at that, there are attempts being made, but some of it is beyond what our current laws are really meant to address.
Okay, so I think we'll let that stand as the last question. I pledged that we would get out by 11:30, and I want to take this opportunity to thank an absolutely terrific panel, including our two second team members of the panel who've done a terrific job.
For more information, visit the Migration Policy Institute at www.migrationpolicy.org.